about public safety budget.
Hello. If everybody will take their seat. Folks in the audience, please take your seat and bring the volume down and we'll start the meeting. We don't have a quorum yet, so what we'll do is would please quit the talking out there in the crowd. We don't have a quorum yet, so what we'll do is begin with our, or continue our public testimony on House File 853 and for those wishing to testify, we've got a sign-up sheet that you'll have to sign on.
Is that in the back?
Up here in the front, the page has got the sign-up sheet. All right, we're going to begin again today with the human rights folks, and you understand you have 5 minutes to share, and you can go ahead and state your name and title and begin, please.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Kevin Lindsay. I'm the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Human Rights. I was approached by one of the members of this committee with a friendly amendment as relates to proposed language concerning restoring the ability of the commissioner to be able to secure grants to address issues concerning discrimination. The committee, I appreciate the effort in drafting the language. The commissioner will look at the language and get back to you with those respective comments. I do just briefly want to indicate and show you one program which we have used in the past 5 years, and this is called This Is My Home. This particular material was submitted to all school districts within the state of Minnesota, and it talked about combating discrimination. So this is the type of programming in which the commission has worked collaboratively with foundations. And I'll provide further information to all committee members as it relates to potential opportunities which are out there. I'd like at this time to introduce Ralph Wyman from Minnesota Hire. And picking up on the chair's comment about 3 pages from yesterday, I did check. Mr. Wyman only has 1 page.
Okay. Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members. Thank you for this opportunity to speak. My name is Ralph Wyman. I'm the director of the Minnesota Unitarian Universalist Social Justice Alliance. With congregations from Mankato to Matamidi, Bemidji and Duluth, and Rochester to the Twin Cities, we organize our members as a public voice for the values of our faith. We're now in our third year as members of the Hire Minnesota Coalition, and our particular work at Hire focuses on employment equity in public contracting. One of our top priorities is the nearly $1 billion being invested in light rail in the Central Corridor Line. Last summer, the Economic Policy Institute released the national report, Uneven Pain, which showed that among 18 major U.S. cities, this metro area had the largest disparity in unemployment comparing black unemployment rates to whites. The disparities for other communities of color are nearly as troubling. The disparities in that context, we believe that major public investments in infrastructure have a significant role to play in addressing and overcoming this gap. We applaud the Metropolitan Council under the Pawlenty administration for setting strong goals for hiring minority workers and women in construction. But to turn those goals into a ladder of opportunity that lifts people out of poverty, the community needs the participation of the Minnesota Department of Human Rights. Hire has been working closely with both Met Council and MDHR. Together, we're holding contractors accountable during last year's preliminary phase of construction and currently in developing the critically important workforce projections that will now allow training programs, union halls, and communities along the rail line to develop the skilled, diverse workforce that can build CCLRT. Success on this project means a workforce will grow towards equitably reflecting the increased diversity of the people living in Minnesota. The Department of Human Rights has been an effective partner to Hire and to the community in building transparency and accountability into the process of contracting and workforce diversity. MDHR's role in contract compliance has already proven critical to us. If the department had lacked contract compliance ability these past few months, we might be in a position right now, as the orange barrels are going up on University Avenue, of not knowing who from our communities needed to be trained, apprenticed, or recruited, and where they needed to be deployed into these family-sustaining living wage jobs. Significant public money is being invested in Central Corridor. A good portion of those funds are locally generated sales tax dollars. HIRE believes strongly in and works tirelessly to ensure that our public trust, our community's investments, help lift people out of poverty, reduce racial disparities, and contribute to healthier communities for all of us. The Minnesota Department of Human Rights is essential to ensuring the public trust, essential to working to close our worst in the nation racial gap in employment, and essential to a public contracting process that's equitable, honorable, and that reflects the values of the good citizens of Minnesota. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, folks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Well, I should ask if there was any questions from any members, but okay, appreciate it.
Thank you.
Next, we have Commissioner Doman and is it Deputy Commissioner Allison or Assistant Commissioner? I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, half of my team is not here yet. I think probably due to traffic. Could we go to the next a couple on the
sure.
list and then come back to us?
You bet, Commissioner.
Please. Thank you.
And then Jim Franklin, the Director of the Sheriff's Association. Come on down. Director Franklin.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Jim Franklin.
Director, I forgot to tell you, 5 minutes shared between the two of you. All right? Thank you,
Mr. Chairman. Jim Franklin, Executive Director of Minnesota Sheriff's Association, and with me today is Dave Peacha, the Executive Director for the Chiefs Association. I'll be uncharacteristically brief. Our concerns are several. Number one, on Section 5, Line 14.2, dealing with the DOC issues, and specifically the short-term offender issue. We appreciate what you're doing, and going from 180 days to 60 days, it is important to us that we thank you for that. We just have to raise two concerns. Number one, there's no provision in here that would help us in our jails deal with any kind of catastrophic medical costs that would be associated with an inmate during that 60-day period of time. Some of those costs are exorbitant. They can run into the thousands and hundreds of thousands of dollars, and those would all be borne by the county. Secondly, if we have a very difficult inmate to try to deal with, we are not necessarily equipped in the jails to deal with that inmate. There's no provision by which we can transfer that inmate back to the prison facility, which would be better suited for that. Secondly, I'd like to thank the committee, and on Section 10, Line 18.7, on the medical aid that has been afforded, the medical rate for Anoka County would now be extended to all 87 counties. That is a definite improvement, and thank you. That does help us. Third comment is on the armor system and the transfer of those funds. This is unprecedented in what you are doing with that. We just raised the concern that I believe was raised yesterday about what that does to the bonding issue, bonding rate. Secondly, those funds are transferred and collected by cell phone and other users in the 911 fee, and those fees do support the county. We're concerned about what impact that has on the build-out, whether or not the bonds can be sold, whether or not that may affect counties moving forward on either A, implementation of the armor system, or B, the new next-gen 911 system that has to be put into place due to the aging current 911 system that we have. And our final comment, Mr. Chairman, deals with the post board and the decrease in the funding there. Again, that has been a continuous issue that we've seen. We're, again, facing decreased officers on the street, increased demands for services, increased demands for training, and less dollars to do it. So we just share those concerns with you.
Thank you, Director Franklin.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, on behalf of the Chiefs of Police Association, we support the Sheriff's Association, particularly on the jail issue, in which we are the number one users of their services. We're the ones that bring the individuals to the jail, including the medical aid, because it is our customers that are brought there. As far as the armor improvements go, you can see the collaboration between police and the county sheriffs and the state patrol, and many of the issues that we do relative to the armor and the interoperability piece is of major concern to us. And finally, on the post board reimbursement for some of our members, this is the only way that they're able to train their officers, in that the training fees are reimbursed by the state through the post board, of which we are very grateful, and we're hoping that that will not get cut. Thank you.
Thank you, folks. Just in reply, I wanted to restate a couple of things here. There's a good case to be made for doing differently what we do now. In other words, there was two studies done, professional studies. The first one, 1995, by Brandel Weber, that, quote, "The state's criminal justice system is inefficiently organized. Funding for local entities is fragmented, making coordination and consistency nearly impossible. Today we have a distorted situation in which the locally funded components of the system, law enforcement and prosecution, determine what state-funded components, courts, public defense, probation, and corrections are obligated to process and pay. And the recommendation was incarcerate in county facilities those offenders with short sentences. They recommended all offenders with less than 1 year be housed locally." And then in another report, "Paying the Price," by Minnesota Planning in 96, their recommendation was shift short-term offenders to county jails. One option that would reduce costs and free up some prison beds would be to assign all short-term felony offenders, those with less than 1 year of prison time, to serve at the time they are sentenced to county jails instead of state facilities. And I think that's, you know, for a couple of reasons. I think that the point was that where these people are coming from, the counties and cities should share in the cost as well as the confinement. And there is another recommendations from the Department of Corrections executive summary that talks about the same thing, the complications of putting all these people in state prisons, and that goes towards sentencing guidelines and some other things. So there is a credible argument that the counties should take care of some of these costs. And I was a jailer in Blue Earth County in the jail system then, and we had ways of segregating prisoners. Even we had violent prisoners in there that everything from commit suicide to basically go crazy and tear up things. That we had segregation cells, we had padded cells. That was way back in 1975, and the jails are much better handled by video surveillance and better staff now than they were then. I was the only jailer on duty at night. We had 63 prisoners, and I think the staffing is a lot better than that now. So I think this is livable to 60 days, and that's why we brought it way back down to 60 days, and here they're talking less than a year. So, and the funding for the training, that's why we increased the time of the frequency for the training, for pursuit training, and the calculations from the post board say that there will actually be, by the changing from 4 to 5 years for the pursuit training, remember, it was a biennium ago, we switched it from 3 to 4. It's the director Melton's communication to us that would more than save the money that we're reducing by allowing you to have one more year in the frequency of training. And amazingly, even though we switched it from 3 to 4 years, some chiefs are still training every 3 years, and when they don't have to. I really don't know why, but there's a number of them that are. So anyway, that's just some information for you folks and where our heads are and figuring this all out. And I don't know if it's going to be a permanent change instead of a budget fix for the future of expecting the counties to take these, or if there's going to be funding that goes along with it. But for now, we're stuck with this and 60 days with no per diem reimbursement. So that's just our plan for now. So thank you very much for your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for your comments. I appreciate them very much, and we're willing to work with you. And I would just make one comment with regards to criminal justice system. I've been here 44 years now, and back in those days we had justice of the peace, municipal court, district court, state court. We had a different discretion, different levels. You are correct, some of the different charges. I think at some point in time cities and counties would be willing to sit down and redesign the entire system, maybe perhaps looking backwards and as we look forward.
I mean, it's amazing the same people are still in jail, it seems like. I went down to the jail where I used to be a jailer and looked through the roster. Unbelievable kids and the grandkids of the people that I was there. So, yeah, there are a lot of similar things going on. Thanks, gentlemen.
And then thank you, Mr. Chair. And just one comment on the pursuit training. There are chiefs that see this as one of the most dangerous activities their officers get involved in, and so they see that the additional training is worthwhile in that respect to keep both the community safe, the officers safe, and the offenders safe. Thank you.
Thank you. Commissioner Doman, are you prepared? All right. Commissioner, you folks have got 5 minutes, however you want to share that, and appreciate you being here today.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Members of the committee, thank you, and thank you for allowing us to slip back on the list a little bit so we could get everybody here. First of all, members of the committee and Mr. Chair, I'd like to acknowledge that we recognize the position of the committee and the difficult decisions that you are making as you balance the budget. And I'd also just like to say that we greatly appreciate the support to public safety that you give on a regular basis. Having said that, I'm here to express our concern about the cuts to DPS. We support the governor's budget, and the cuts presented here will have a detrimental effect on public safety as we work throughout the state. The Office of Justice Programs and the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension cuts ultimately will result in a reduction of services to local agencies and services to crime victims and our youth in our state. The disaster assistance match cut will burden local agencies who have already been so impacted by their shrinking budgets. I'd also like to acknowledge that the governor's recommendation of $2.9 million to fund the Network for Better Futures is not included in your proposals. And I would imagine that they have somebody in the room that might be willing to testify if you have any questions for them. I recognize that you indicated that they could apply for burn grant monies to maybe fund their program. I would just like to remind you that those burn grant monies and funds are already allocated to other services or and other programs, and so that would mean cutting some other services that we provide. I do have division directors in the room if you have any questions, but before that, with your permission, Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn the microphone over to Deputy Commissioner Mary Ellison. She'd like to talk about the ARMOR program.
Welcome, Deputy Commissioner. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mary Ellison, Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Public Safety. I want to bring up this ARMOR 911 program again and just express our very deep concerns about taking money from this fund. I know we have disagreed about this in the past, but there is a federal law that says that states can only collect 911 fees if they use it for 911 purposes. Not only do we feel that this is a would be a break with the bondholders that we currently have, a breach of contract with the bondholders that we currently have, it would lower our bond rating, puts in jeopardy of our bond rating into the future, because we would have to disclose that the legislature has tapped into this fund for another purpose. We have to certify for a $1.4 million grant that we get from the federal government that we do not use 911 purposes for anything other than 911. And we have noticed with other states that they have, if they have not been able to certify that, they have been disallowed from receiving those grants. And so I know you also all received a message from Assistant Commissioner at MMB, Minnesota Management and Budget, Kristen Hansen, that talks about their concerns about taking money from the 911 fund for this purpose. So I know you only gave us 5 minutes worth of time. I appreciate all the people that have to testify that can, you know, tell you about many different concerns that they have, but I didn't want that to not be on the record that we have a very deep concern about that fund.
Okay. Thank you very much. Commissioner, anything to close with?
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Any questions? Appreciate your testimony. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Now, for the folks that are left, if we have people from victim services and advocate for women's shelters and things like this, if a number of them in a row, you need to probably shorten up your testimony because it's going to get to the point where you just agree with the person in front of you. So, Anna McClafferty?
Good morning, Chair, members of the committee. I'm Anna McLafferty, the Criminal Justice Director at NAMI Minnesota, which is the National Alliance on Mental Illness of Minnesota. We're a statewide grassroots nonprofit organization that works to improve the lives of people with mental illnesses and their families through education, support, and advocacy. And nearly 100% of our board and members either live with a mental illness, have a family member who does, or both. With the high rate of overlap between substance use disorders and mental illnesses, NAMI's concerned about the proposed cut of 90 beds, substance use treatment beds at Faribault. The availability of chemical dependency treatment is just as much a public safety issue as the availability of corrections officers and probation officers. In addition to the DOC's finding that this treatment program reduces recidivism by 30%, many of NAMI's thousands of members have been in the criminal justice system or have loved ones who have. And when they talk about what helped them turn their lives around, it's almost always has to do with treatment. And I can say without the presence of effective treatment in my own family, I could have been one of the very children that you were talking about, Chair Cornish, when you were saying that some of the children and grandchildren of the people that you jailed are now on the record. We do believe that there are other proven ways to achieve cost savings, like alternative sentencing, integrating mental health and chemical dependency treatment, and increased collaboration between mental health providers and probation to reduce release violations for people on probation who have serious mental illnesses and go back because of their symptoms. Meanwhile, these 90 treatment beds are an important part of Minnesota's infrastructure of cost-saving measures to keep people safe and healthy in the community. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate it. And, you know, we're not completely unaware of problems out there with family problems and this and that, and we realize that there's all sorts of problems. I myself had a couple of different juvenile probation officers, and my grandpa's been part of his life in the Stillwater State Prison, so I don't think any family is really untouched somewhere in their past, so it's not like we're unaware of the effect that this could have on personal life. So, yes, Representative Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, do you have any statistics of people who have dual diagnosis of chemical dependency and mental illness?
The Bureau of Justice Statistics has looked at that and found that about 64% of people in prisons across the country live with a mental illness, and 72% of that population also has co-occurring substance use disorders.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, ma'am. Appreciate it. Tony from Anoka County Attorneys. When you folks write your names here, it's hard for me to read them. So, hello, Tony.
Yeah, morning. Morning.
That's a good name.
Tony Palumbo, P-A-L-U-M-B-O. I am the Anoka County Attorney, and I'm here to speak to the Office of Justice Programs, the reduction for the Battered Women's Shelter. Very briefly, I am to speak to the value of the services of the Anoka County's women's shelter known as Alexandra House. Alexandra House is a critical part of the Anoka County response to domestic violence and to sexual assault in Anoka County. They are our partners in what we have instituted as a program known as the Lethality Assessment. This comes out of the state of Maryland in 1991, has been incorporated in law enforcement in Anoka County. When officers arrive on a domestic abuse scene, they conduct a series of 12 questions which determine whether the potential for lethality is great or low. Since we've instituted this program in September of 2010, we have had an incident of about 69% of those situations become high-risk lethality. What happens when there is such a high risk? The parties are referred to the services of Alexandra House, the women's shelter in Anoka County. Obviously, Alexandra House is a community resource. They are partners with Anoka County in trying to handle what we consider to be a growing problem. Unfortunately, Anoka County leads the metro area in domestic abuse deaths per 100,000 people. That's not a statistic that we'd like to be number one in. We'd like to reverse that trend, certainly. Alexandra House is a critical resource. They are a private partner in our public safety needs of Anoka County, and I would urge this committee, and I know you have very difficult choices, but I would urge the committee strongly to consider the impact of any to public safety if there is a reduction in funding for such critical programs that certainly serve the needs of Anoka County as well as other counties throughout the state of Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it. And next we have Richard Kolodzinski from MAPE. Sorry if I hacked up your name.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Richard Kajewski, the Legislative Affairs Director with MAPE. And Mr. Chair, I just learned how to say my name last week anyway, so don't be offended by that. Mr. Chair, we are adamantly opposed to removing the job classes that have been removed in the bill from the Corrections Early Retirement Program. Most of the employees in that plan receive similar training to those who are left in the plan. Most are expected to respond to security incidents in the security hospitals. But all are supervising our most dangerous offenders and patients, many in isolated areas, many without security staff present. All are trained and can be exposed to bodily fluids and bloodborne pathogens. And, Mr. Chair, all enter a secured gate, a Sallyport door. They walk down the same sidewalks, into the same cell blocks as people who are covered. Each and every day, those people put their life on the line. Many of these facilities, with people who are not covered by that plan, are not inside those locked premises. Mr. Chair, in 1995, I too began a career with the Department of Corrections and went through training and through their academy. And I remember seeing a video with a staff with a knife to their throat where they walked up to the Sallyport, the last door before an inmate could exit the facility. And it was clear what the responsible thing to do is there, and that is you don't unlock that last door. And I guess the point I make to everybody in this committee, Mr. Chair, is those positions in statute that are being repealed put their life on the line every single day. It's a much more stressful environment, although, Mr. Chair, I would maybe contest that I'm starting to compete this session. This bill literally eliminates the criteria that they all have, the 75% of inmate contact. Approximately 1,500 hours a year, 6 out of 8 hours a day. They're not getting rich. They're not overpaid. They're asking for the benefits and the terms and conditions that they sought the employment in these facilities and institutions for. Mr. Chair, the second piece I would just comment on is you've heard testimony on the Department of Human Rights. MAPE represents the people who conduct the investigations over at the Department of Human Rights. They are the final stop between discrimination and harassment, which often leads people to physical illness, resignation from employment. Our members in that agency, Mr. Chair, are long-term employees. They don't turn over. They do more than they ever have because positions have been repeatedly cut. They take a great deal of pride in the work they do, and they do it because they believe in it. And they do it because the citizens expect and need it. Their education programs, their work on racial equality, and their day-to-day work and investigations, Mr. Chair, is unmatched. It's relied upon service in state government, and it's essential. Mr. Chair, with other bills going through the legislature right now, including a 12% workforce cut that's separate from the cuts in this bill, there's not going to be anybody left to do that work. So, Mr. Chair, I'd ask you to consider those two things. With that, I thank you for your time here today, unless anybody has any questions.
Thank you, sir. Any questions? Appreciate your testimony. Thank you. Tell me from Coalition. Welcome.
Good morning, Representative Cornish, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Tao Mei Shong, and I'm with the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women. I'm the public policy specialist there. The Coalition is a statewide organization with 83 local, regional, and national member organizations. For more than 30 years, we served as a unifying voice for battered women and domestic violence programs throughout the state of Minnesota. Public safety is a core function of government, and domestic violence programs play a vital role in providing safety and security to countless women, children, and men in the state of Minnesota. Thousands of diverse families across Minnesota seek safety every year by going to their local domestic violence programs for multifaceted services such as shelter, safe housing, community advocacy, and education. In addition, our programs play an important leadership role in the development of partnerships across systems, such as law enforcement, prosecutors, and the courts. These partnerships and collaborations ensure that our systems work as efficiently and effectively as possible to protect victims and hold offenders accountable. Today we were going to have two survivors testify about their stories and the services that they received, but due to the weather they weren't able to make it. But lucky for you, we actually wrote down their stories in these Faces of Domestic Violence campaign, and when I'm done, I'll pass them out. But one story is Jennifer Denmark. She received services from Southern Valley Alliance, and she was in an abusive relationship for 17 years. Her husband raped her, beat her, and finally she decided to leave. When she was going to leave and she started applying for a divorce, her husband broke into her home, violated an order for protection, and held her at knife point in front of her 8-year-old daughter and threatened to kill her. But luckily, with the help of an advocate, they prepared a safety plan, and the code word to put in place the safety plan was run. So when she said that, her daughter left through the door, which distracted her husband, or soon-to-be ex-husband, and she was able to escape as well. The second story is Kelly Jo. Kelly Jo had a normal relationship until something happened, and her boyfriend basically just started abusing her. And for 3 days straight, he beat her, raped her, and stuck a knife in her ear, basically tortured her for 3 days in front of his 5-year-old son. Finally, in the early morning, she escaped the house and found refuge from 5 blocks down the street from a neighbor. With the support of her advocate from the St. Paul Intervention Project, she was able to have the courage to go to court and to testify against him, and now he's been sentenced to 9 years in jail. So our programs provide critical services to victims of domestic violence. But Jennifer and Kelly Jo are the lucky ones, actually. Every year, the coalition documents the number of femicides that occur in the state of Minnesota. Last year, in 2010, there were 28 deaths related to domestic violence. And all too often, battering ends in death. And the victims of the ongoing abuse are not the only people affected. As you've heard, there's police officers, family members, friends, neighbors, even strangers that have been killed while trying to intervene in domestic violence situations, changing families and communities forever. This is a difficult economy and budget cycle. However, during these tough economic times that our communities are most vulnerable to violence, and we urge our government leaders, you, to stay vigilant on making public safety a core responsibility of government, a top priority. Minnesota has long recognized that services for victims of domestic violence are essential to the safety and well-being of families across the state. Please support funding for these programs that are critical to so many families in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. What in the last budget cuts when OJP was cut, how are you folks treated?
I'm sorry?
In the last budget cuts that we did last biennium, how were you folks treated in the coalition?
I will defer to my ED.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Cindy Cook. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women. And for those of you who know me, I have a vocal cord issue. It sounds really bad. It doesn't hurt. And I'm not crying. So.
Okay, I just wanted to
although
know.
I might
how,
be, depending
we just wanted to answer the question, how did you fare in the last set of budget cuts in the last biennium?
In the last biennium, crime victim services programs was a cap of 1.5% cut, and the biennium before it was capped at 3%.
Okay, so in both ones you were protected more than the rest of them?
For
the rest of the cut.
Domestic violence programs specifically.
What's that?
Mr. Chair, are you asking about domestic violence programs specifically or all crime victim services?
Your coalition.
Our coalition?
How many chunks?
They're the same as all of the other crime victim services programs.
Okay, well, rather than put you all through this here with your voice, we protected you folks before in cuts, and we're protecting you this time from cuts when other people are getting deeper cuts. I just want you to realize that. Okay?
I understand that, Mr.
I mean, you're aware of this bill that will recap the cuts to women's shelters, correct?
Okay. Yes, we are, Mr.
All right. I just wanted you to know, be aware of that. Okay, thank you much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
If I may make a note that when we talk about domestic violence services, it's also critical to us that the sexual assault programs, child abuse programs, and general crime programs are supported as well, because it's a whole system that we rely on. So I wanted to make that point.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, now that we've got a quorum, we'll bring the meeting to official order and start out with a roll call.
Cornish.
Here.
Woodard.
Here.
Mullery. Gauthier.
Here.
Grunhagen.
Here.
Hilty.
Here.
Kelly.
Here.
Kiefer.
Here.
Kreisel.
Here.
Leidiger. Mariani.
Here.
McDonald.
Here.
Moran.
Here.
Nornis.
Here.
Slocum.
Here.
Smith.
Here.
Okay, thank you, and I would like someone to offer a motion to approve the minutes of March 22nd.
So moved.
Representative Kreisel moves the minutes of March 22nd. Any additions or corrections? Yeah. Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. We're back to testimony. Chief of Bloomington. John. You remember me?
Yes, sir.
How you doing?
Good.
Good. Good. Go ahead.
Chair and committee members, it is interesting to be back after so many years being away, seeing some familiar faces. I'm here as wearing many hats, but retired. Police chief in Minneapolis, 28 years there as an officer. Bloomington police chief, director of the post board. I mention this because what I am going to remark about comes from experience, not from books. I started as a street cop in 1968, and as your chair has mentioned, had a lot of experiences with people and generational. Domestic violence seems to be a generational issue too. It's a learned behavior, which you grow up in a household learning how to treat or mistreat somebody by example. And that continues from generation to generation. This is a question of saving lives. You heard previously that there was 28 deaths in Minnesota in 2010. In 2009, there was 22 deaths related to domestic violence. You have and continue to support domestic violence issues. In comparison, Wisconsin does not do such a good job of supporting domestic violence. In 2009, 67 deaths attributed to domestic violence. So, dollars do matter. Support does matter. I think Wisconsin being of equal size really shows that these dollars do save lives. But I'm here to speak about a public safety issue for police officers. When I started in 1968, our training was minimal, our equipment was minimal. Now we have much increased training. We have ballistic vests. We have better communication equipment. We have cameras. We have recorders. We have all sorts of things to help keep us safe. But going on a domestic violence call, as Mr. Chair can attest to, is still one of the most dangerous events for a public safety officer to respond to. So we need to continue our quest to train, to respond appropriately, and to continue to try to save lives. Who does this affect? It affects, as victims and perpetrators, it affects doctors, lawyers, the common clerk at the grocery store, judges. It affects police officers, and yes, it affects legislators. My point being, it's across the board. There isn't one single population that is immune from domestic violence. So I think it's something that touches everybody. And as I mentioned, it is a generational issue. So I like to frame it as, think of domestic violence as an investment in a safer community. The more people we can protect, the more people that can lead healthy lives through these programs, the healthier our community will be. And we do it in collaboration. We all talk in the last several years about working with other people. We work police, prosecutors, healthcare, schools, advocate, community funders. And here's another point I'd like to make. As a board member at Cornerstone, which serves five suburban communities, we raise over half of our funds ourselves. We're not sitting back waiting for the state to fund us fully. We go out and we have galas, we have Walk a Mile in Her Shoes, we have a number of things to raise dollars to offset expenses. So we're trying to do our part and meet you, so to speak, halfway on the funding issues. So I think my time is winding down. But we do save lives. I know it from personal experience. I know it from talking to victims. And I know it from the statistics. Thank you, and I'd be happy to stand for questions.
Thank you, Chief. Representative Slocum.
Keep the glasses on, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I just want to say that I've known Chief Locks from his time in Minneapolis and his time in Bloomington, and he is a marvelous human being. When he talks about his work at Cornerstone, he's talking not as a police chief. He's talking as a retired person who volunteers his time. And, gentlemen, if you've never walked a mile in high heel shoes for pledges, you ought to give it a try. It's an eye-opening experience for both men and women. Thank you.
Might pass on that one. Thank you, Chief. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Commissioner Robin West from Anoka County. And I'll let you know when you're about four minutes and 45 seconds. So.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to present on behalf of Alexander House. Alexander House is the only domestic sexual violence shelter in Anoka County, where in the past 5 years, 70% of our murders have been domestic homicides. Why is it so important for me to be here today as a county commissioner is to speak to the necessity of these services. We need to stop this violence, and Anoka County and its law enforcement agencies cannot do it alone. Alexander House is much more than an emergency shelter for women and children fleeing domestic and/or sexual violence. It's a critical component of our community's response to public safety and public health. Without the services and expertise of Alexander House, our criminal justice and health care systems could not effectively respond to the victims of these horrendous crimes. Hundreds of women and children would not have a safe place to go when they're fleeing for their very lives. Ensuring our community's public safety and public health is a core and essential function of government. And I believe that reflects the priorities of our society as a whole, as well as this committee. Alexandra House, located in the cities of Blaine and Anoka, is not merely a local service provider, but it provides essential services to over 2,700 victims of domestic and sexual violence from across the metro area and the state of Minnesota each year. Its services include 24-hour emergency shelter and crisis line, legal and court advocacy, legal assistance and legal clinics, criminal justice intervention, hospital-based support and advocacy, support and education groups, follow-up in-home services, and an in-shelter K-12 school, which is so important for the continuity of their schooling in this very traumatic time in the lives of these children. A food shelf, youth violence prevention programming through our local schools, community education, and professional training services. Unique in many ways, Alexandra House has extremely strong collaborations and partnerships with local schools, law enforcement agencies, hospitals, local government, and businesses throughout our community. And that results in a more coordinated response to these crimes by the broader community. But there's much more work to be done to make our community a safer place for everyone. We cannot afford to lose ground from the good work that Alexandra House has done in partnership with our community.
You shorten it up, ma'am, and we've got 15 seconds.
15 seconds. Well, I just want to know, as you know, in Anoka County, we are making very, very large efforts because we have to cut our funding. And Alexandra House and Anoka County cannot afford to lose the funding that we are not in a position to replace for them right now. And I thank you so much for this time.
Ma'am, what funding do you get from Anoka County itself?
I am an Anoka County Commissioner. We give them money through development block grant, community development block grants, and the Anoka County Attorney's Office also, in which they are a huge help in dealing with victims of sexual assault, because a lot of professionals aren't really sure what to do with these situations to prevent.
But the question was, how much money does the Alexandra House get from Anoka County?
I am sorry, I don't have that figure. It's a little over $70,000 between three sources in Anoka County.
What percentage of that is your total budget, you think? Just offhand, what approximately?
8 or 10? We have a little over $2 million budget.
So it's around 8%, I think. Or no, it's way lower. 0.8%.
How come, I just wonder why they don't give more? If it's that successful a program and it's that helpful to the county attorney's office, I'm just wondering why they don't fund it more than that amount.
Our funds are very limited, but because they do such a good job of raising funds for their organization as well.
Anoka County is huge with a very large budget, and it just seems a paltry amount to commit and expect the state to pick up a large amount. I mean, just a side comment. I mean, if it's a very successful program, and a lot of that's a problem that I'm looking at in the OJP grants. Our frustration is, they're critical, but, and they help out the county attorney's office, they help out the courts, they do all this stuff, but the county still thinks that we're not doing our share, and that some of these counties could afford to pay more and aren't, and are paying more for less vital services. So,
well, Anoka County runs very leanly, but Anoka County is also economically not quite as affluent as many of the other metro counties. So we make very, very good use of our funds.
Okay, thank you. For the testifiers that are coming up, we're going to shorten that down to probably 2 minutes. With everybody in the list, we're never going to get done if we don't. And especially if it's a redundant testimony over the same points that somebody else has covered. Because once we hear, you know, from a number of victim services, we get the point. And we know how critical these services are, and so restating is burning up committee time. Louis Celeski, Mid-Minnesota? or Louise. Sorry about that. If you could hold it to a couple of minutes, we'd sure appreciate it.
I'll do my best. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Louise Selesky, the Executive Director of the Mid-Minnesota Women's Center, the Shelter for Battered Women, and the Alex and Brandon Child Safety Center, a parenting time center located in Brainerd. I've been the Executive Director of the shelter for 33 years. In 2000, added a service to our shelter, and that was the Alex and Brandon Child Safety Center. The program was named after Alex, age 5, and Brandon, age 4. They were children in our support group at the shelter, and their mother, Angie, was in our battered women's support group. Although Angie asked for supervised visits with their father, the judge denied the request. On July 3, 1996, their father, Kurt Frank, on an unsupervised visit, murdered both boys by cutting their throats. We built Alex and Brandon so that this would not happen again, and the boys would never be forgotten. I caught this from Cindy, I think. It has always cost more to operate the Alex and Brandon Child Safety Center than what we take in. We cannot charge the parents what it cost us for a visit, and the visits cost us $56 an hour, and most of the parents are paying between $5 and $20 an hour. We get a very small grant from the Department of Public Safety, and we also do what we can to earn money from various kinds of fundraisers, donations, everything else. And we do walk a mile in her shoes. And the former commissioner of public safety came to walk. So if he can do it, I'm sure there are some other men who can do it here. One of the things I wanted to talk about is that the most dangerous
part. Got about a minute left.
Okay. The most dangerous time for a woman is when she leaves an abusive relationship. That's also what happened to Alex and Brandon. Their mother was leaving that relationship. It cost our state over $1 million to keep Kurt Frank in prison for the murder of two little boys that loved him. That does not include the cost of law enforcement, autopsies, the county attorney, the funerals, court costs, and the highest cost of all, the emotional toll that it took and continues to take on their mother, family, friends, neighbors, and others who knew him. Our shelter has, without a doubt, prevented many murders. My point is that our programs pay for themselves. I know that you have had many people from worthy programs who have come here to ask that you not cut their programs. I am here to make that same request. Our programs enhance public safety, and all citizens benefit from it. Please don't be penny wise and pound foolish. Thank you for your time and all you have done for our wonderful state, as well as the services that have been provided for domestic abuse.
Thank you very much. I'm going to bring why don't we bring the network up now? And I'm going to give you folks 5 minutes because you were here yesterday and the time limit was 5. And you can have as many people say words as you want, but just limit it to 5 minutes. So you got until about a quarter after.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman Cornish and members of the committee. My name is Makram El-Amin. I'm a life coach with the Network for Better Futures. And with me today are a number of men from the Network for Better Futures, and we thank you for the opportunity to make some brief remarks. The legislature provided funding for our demonstration, a project for the past two biennium, and we encourage the committee to recommend one-time funding for the $2.9 million for the next biennium. With this level of investment, we will complete our five-year pilot and demonstration to demonstrate proven strategies for reducing spending and controlling future costs. More importantly, during these times of fiscal distress and the need to cut spending, this investment will enable us to document reduced spending in multiple agencies, create 12 new full-time equivalent job slots, which will employ 180 different men over the next biennium. Save the state more than it is invested. These savings will be verified through an independent evaluation and earn the state's investment by being paid to perform and share some financial risk for better outcomes. We have attracted bipartisan support because of we are demonstrating a very effective way to reduce financial and social costs of high-risk adults, primarily African-American men, with histories of incarceration, substance abuse, mental illness, chronic unemployment, and homelessness. Since 2008, we have enrolled and served over 430 high-risk men. In 2010, 75% of active network men were employed. 75% of men who owed child support were making their payments, compared to an existing rate of about 15%. Most of our men were connected to a medical home and received physical examinations and behavioral health assessments. All our men have access to safe and stable housing, drug treatment, and job training services. Less than 10% of the men who were active for 90 days or more returned to prison for committing a new felony. This recidivism rate is 60% less than the current rate. We have provided the state with a generous return on its investment. We estimate that for every $1 invested in the network, we generate about $3 in return benefits. Our social innovation interrupts the cycle of expensive cycle of reincarceration and failure that this population currently experiences. Moreover, current practices reinforce dependency on government services and undermine personal responsibility. We want to be held accountable for saving the state money, creating jobs, and achieving much better results. If we don't meet some or all of these expectations, we are willing to pay a financial penalty. In closing, we respectfully ask this committee to recommend the 2.9 in one-time funding for the next biennium so we can complete our five-year pilot demonstration and demonstrate proven strategies for reducing spending and controlling future costs. Committee Chair, we also have a letter of support from Paul Coles as well that we'd like to circulate to the committee as well. And I'm open to taking any questions that may happen from the committee and the chair.
Okay. Would you be able to answer financial questions about the organization, or would you have your representative come up there?
I do my very best to do that, yes.
It's not so much questions, it's just the things that we looked over when we were considering, you know, funding. And the network has, and I'm sure you probably heard this in the Senate, has been funded through the housing before and through economic development. And they've also received a number of burn grants, I think quite sizable ones. And so I had a list of them here somewhere, but like $100,000, Mr. Carter?
Mr. Chair, I do not have the list, but I think in that the burn grants, I think they were funded for three time periods, three different grant funds, if I remember. I guess they're saying one grant, 2 years.
One grant, 2 years. Yeah, I was looking through these pages here, and let's see, in 2011, $100,000, and 1031 of it says Network for Better Futures, $959,000, and $240,000. You add all those up, or what this spreadsheet is talking about? the grants, federally funded grants, and there's one for $240,000, and those other large ones, $100,000 and $900,000, or
$900,000. Mr. Chair, Nancy Hilden on behalf of the network. I'll just briefly walk over the overarching funding that the legislature has approved. I don't have access to the numbers that you're looking at, but here's the overarching numbers.
Okay, just use about 60 seconds, ma'am.
Will do.
If you could.
In the first biennium, two bienniums ago, this demonstration project was started, and by its nature, it's one time because it's not, it's a demonstration project. We received $1.6 million that was appropriated through the corrections budget, I'll say. The second biennium, we secured one-time funding again through deed, totaling $300,000, MHFA, $500,000, and the Byrne grant, or the federal Office of Justice grant, of $1.3 million. That cobbled together a total of $2.1 million. So in the first biennium, the state funded this demonstration project for $1.6 million. In the second biennium, it was for $2.1 million, and that is matched and exceeded, actually, by some private philanthropic dollars. So the funding request this year is a modest increase, but again, we're just now at that point of really getting to a first cohort of participants who are at the recidivism rate, so we can actually look at real numbers. And what is most exciting about this pilot is that it actually is now showing its worth, and it's only because the legislature had the foresight to put it out long enough term so that we could actually show these kinds of results. This third biennium request would complete, as you heard from Mr. Melamine, would complete the demonstration.
Okay. Representative Kelly.
Mr. Chair, I'll be brief. Mr. Alamine, something you stated kind of struck me because we don't hear it very often. You said you want to be held accountable. Can you help me out with that? What does that mean for us?
Yes, Mr. Chair, committee, we're proposing that a portion of the funds that we receive from the state be held. And if our men or a man either is not employed, is not housed, is not paying child support, or return to prison, that we should pay a financial penalty for not meeting the outcomes. We want to be held accountable to the state for the outcomes that we say that we produce, so that the state can see the demonstrated return on investment.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, sir. Any more questions? If not, appreciate your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee.
Leslie Metzen from 360. If you could hold it to a couple of minutes.
Yeah, I will. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Leslie Metzen. I'm the Senior Director of Violence Prevention at 360 Communities. I am not a professional at testifying, although some of you saw me yesterday on another issue. I just happen to be passionate about battered women and abused and neglected children. My organization, 360 Communities, operates the B. Robert Lewis House, named after a former legislator who was actually instrumental in getting us funding. Some questions have been raised during your deliberations about funding for the Office of Justice Programs regarding executive director salaries and also fund balances, funds in reserve in some of these organizations, and I want to speak to those two things specifically. Keep in mind that each of the organizations that operates battered women's shelters throughout the state are all very unique and different, so I can only speak to my organization. Our CEO is among the top of the wage earners. This is a woman who has been with our organization for almost 30 years, I believe. She's been the executive director since 1991, so she has longevity. Secondly, Not one dime of her salary is OJP funded. We are a multi-service organization. We provide a number of services in Dakota County. We do school success work. We do child prevention through a Dakota Healthy Families program. We operate food shelves, and we do community engagement work besides our violence prevention work. So this is a multifaceted organization. And the salary for our CEO is set by our board, and they set that salary after a review of comparables across the metropolitan area and keep it in line with what those comparables are. Regarding the issue of fund balances, again, this is a sum that is set by our board of directors. They require that we maintain 90 days in operating expenses in reserve. Currently, we're at 89 days. This fiscal year, we're facing a $225,000 shortfall in our operating budget, which will require us to go into those reserves further. It is our board's belief that sound fiscal management involves maintaining these funds in reserves. It is particularly the situation that all nonprofits have faced in the last couple of years of tight budgets and grants being cut back and so forth that show that this really is imperative to our well-being. And so that's the purpose that we have that money. Our battered women's shelter, in fact, operates within a set budget year to year, and we don't specifically have any reserves in the budget that we maintain for our battered women's shelter.
Ma'am, you're about 3.5 minutes now already. But
all right, sorry. So I just want to reiterate that the funding for OJP is really foundational support for all of these shelters throughout the state, and I hope I answered some of the questions that were raised by some of you earlier.
The I hadn't planned on asking this question, but as long as you opened the can, but what is the salary of the director, and what was the balance of the reserve that you were talking about that we thought was high?
Our director's salary, which includes all of her benefits and fringes and everything, is about, I think, 172, and she was by far the highest paid of the directors. Many of the directors for battered women's shelters earn in the neighborhood of $50,000, $70,000 a year. So, and as I said, none of that money that pays her salary is funded by any government dollars.
And then the reserve balance you were talking about that we thought was high.
Oh, gosh, I don't know. I can't answer that question. I don't have the numbers in front of me. I'd be happy to submit that later. I think you had the list of all of the fund balances. I think OJP provided that to all of you, and I think that was correct. I'm not disputing whatever those numbers were.
Okay, thank you, ma'am.
Thank you.
Bree Adams, St. Paul. Intervention. A couple minutes, please. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bree Adams-Bill, and I'm an advocate from the St. Paul Intervention Project. And though I know that you've heard from a great deal of programs this morning on from better women's agencies, this is the first you've heard from an advocate this morning. For the sake of time, I just want to highlight a couple points I feel it's important for you to know from me as an advocate, and then if you will, just submit the rest of my testimony in writing if that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Domestic violence programs have two primary purposes. The first is to ensure that victims receive the protection and services they need. The second, however, is to ensure that a society is created that will not tolerate the abuse of any of its members, regardless of their gender, ethnic, cultural, or economical background, age, immigration status, sexual orientation, or spiritual beliefs. Our great state of Minnesota has been a leader in addressing domestic violence. and a few of these initiatives that have been replicated nationally, we're here to speak to you today. Our programs provide an array of services that reflect the realization that one out of every woman has been battered. That is 25% of our population. That is 25% of the districts you represent. And when a victim attempts to leave, she is at a 75% greater risk of being murdered, and that is the reality. Our collaborative efforts in St. Paul, which I would like to say I'm sure are modeled across the state, no doubt, but our efforts here in St. Paul with law enforcement, prosecution, the courts, probation, have significantly decreased and deterred further acts of violence. To date, none of the victims in St. Paul whose offenders have been identified as repeat chronic offenders through a flare-up project that we have and that are monitored by a team that we have been fatally injured. None of them have been. These powerful and committed alliances that we have with our system partners and our sister agencies will one day end domestic violence. That is our goal. And domestic violence programs continue to create the infrastructure to enable that to happen. Thank you.
Thank you very much. For appreciate you. You're the only one that adhered to the time limit so far. Thank you.
May I submit this?
Yeah, ready? You can hand it.
Yeah.
And Linda Miller, we give his 2 minutes.
Thank you. Representative Cornish, representatives, my name is Linda Miller, and I'm here on behalf of 0853 and 0854. You may remember the testimony of Sister Mary of the St. Joseph's of Grand Delay in our last hearing, and also Mynia Kang, who was with the United States Senator Coleman. Two times this week we have been on Fox 9 News at 9 with foreign-born trafficked victims. Not with them, but speaking about the cases. One, we obtained an indictment with the FBI, bringing the victim to the FBI. This is a crisis in Minnesota. Human trafficking is a crisis in Minnesota. I want to save DPS money, and I think that I reasonably can say that having two victims, talking about two victims in front of the news today, that there will be at least 100 victims that will come forward, that we will find in the next year. And then more of that, more the next year after that. So, what my agency is paid to do by the United States government, Health and Human Services, is to process paperwork for benefits to victims, so that the state does not have to pay. Now, we need the cooperation of law enforcement and others in the state to make sure we get these victims, because we process them, and child victims here are eligible for every single benefit here.
Okay. You take about 15 seconds and finish up,
yeah.
Please.
They're eligible for shelter, health care, immigration services, food, legal assistance. And so with this calculation, over 13 million will be saved this year, in the next 2 years, if you fund our two bills, which is $335,000, and you will save over 13 million, and I will hand this out.
Okay, thank you. I remember your math from the other day.
Yeah.
That complicated formula you gave us.
300 kids?
No, you don't have to repeat it.
Okay.
I remembered it. And Ms. Miller, did you apply for this grant yet? The Bureau of Justice Assistance, the Office of Victims of Crime, are announcing the a competitive solicitation, Enhanced Collaborative Model to Combat mm-hmm. Human Trafficking. Have you heard of that one or applied for that then?
This is what I'm doing in my spare time waiting for testifying, is writing it.
That's this one?
Yeah, this
about?
One. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you.
I've had it before.
Okay. Carol Arthur? Hi. 2 minutes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Carol Arthur. I'm the executive director of the Domestic Abuse Project in Minneapolis. Founded in 1979, our agency provides therapy to men who are abusive, to women and children who are victims of domestic violence. Nearly 700 men, women, and children last year in Minneapolis and Hennepin County. We also provide advocacy, working closely with the Minneapolis Police Department to follow up on all domestic assault arrests and gun on arrival reports. Last year, more than 3,600 victims of domestic violence were helped. The Office of Justice Programs provide some funding for our advocacy program and our children's therapy program. I'm going to eliminate most of the other things I wanted to tell you about and instead share with you the voice of Jamie and his mother. This is an example of more than 17,000 911 calls that we receive in the city of Minneapolis every year. Minneapolis is not unique. We're not the domestic assault capital of Minnesota or the world. So you can imagine that this same kind of voice is happening in your community.
Can you please help me?
Whatever.
Can you please help me?
What's wrong?
My mom's old boyfriend is trying to rape my mom, and I'm really scared, and I need help.
Okay, well, just calm down. We're going to send somebody.
Okay. And I think my cat's scared.
Your cat's scared? How old are you? How old are you?
I'm 6.
You're 6?
Yes.
Okay. We have somebody coming.
And I need help.
Somebody?
Mommy!
Mind turning that off?
Absolutely. I ask you all to please consider public safety, to please consider that in the area of domestic violence, it has a particular meaning, and I ask you not to cut services for crime victims. Thank you.
Thank you. It should be noted that, you know, there's a lot of horror stories and bad things that you can tell us, but probably none of our families are untouched by this. I would rather probably have had you rather than go on and repeat and repeat and repeat the same thing. Tell us how you're going to deal with the cuts and how they would affect you financially also, instead of coming up here and repeating the horror stories that many of our families have already been through. They are touching, but we want to know how you want to deal with the financial situation also. I can't read the name here, but Summit something was the organization. Lewis, is that it? All right. Now, public testimony, it looks like it's... What's that? Lewis King? No. Okay, we're going to close public testimony. And begin with the amendments. Unless we've got any questions first. unprocessed. Representative Mullery, why don't I just discuss some of these amendments rather than kibitz over each one or spend needless time here. What my general plan and my general thinking are is that, like I talked to you about before, is I'd like to, just to go over these amendments somewhat, I'd like to accept the amendment that the Department of Corrections had. And about an easement problem they're having with. And I also got an amendment. I understand you had one to restore language from Representative Moran. What I'd like to do instead is offer a modification of that, which would basically have a language change. It keeps the same cut, but like the director that was down here talking to us said it would possibly help him out in applying for grants. In other words, it would tie state funding to enforcement only and federal funding to the education and outreach programs. And then there's also the Juvenile Justice Reform Advisory Task Force. I made another little correction after I talked to you, Representative Mullery, and instead of amending, we got some different language in that one on that and reducing the size of the things, putting in some ones instead of two members. And then I didn't really want to accept your other two on the Sex Offender Task Force. And that's just the general plan. And we can take each one and discuss them and vote on them if you'd like. But just some of my thoughts right now.
And Mr. Chair, first of all, I have no problem with the reduction on the from two to one on the people on the task force on certain things, but it doesn't really make a difference because they're serving without compensation or expense. So I don't really see the problem with it, but I don't care that much about it. With regard to the amendment on human rights, Mr. Chair, you have to totally deal with Representative Moran, and I support her views on it. With regard to the first one you mentioned, the acquisition of the easement, if you feel that that's important. I don't think any of us are going to oppose it, are we? No. No, we won't oppose it if you want to put that on. With regard to the sex offender task force, Mr. Chair, it's extremely important. And I would... what I will do is not use my bill for the advisory, but Mr. Diebel handled that one. I can't remember which one is doing once. I believe Mr. Diebel did a combination of your amendment and my amendment, and by putting on the A10 amendment, that would achieve it. These are really important issues that have to be brought up. And I've talked to people in the system and with agencies, and they understand that these have to be done. And so it's really important that those be in specifically in the task force. Otherwise, we're really not accomplishing anything with the task force if we're not covering these important issues. It's a kind of a useless task force, and what we would be required to do is then I will be and working with some of the agencies and others to set up another whether we call it a working group or whatever, it doesn't make a lot of sense not to have it in the task force so that we have one group studying the whole thing. And if you don't accept it, then we're going to be forced to have two groups studying, and it just doesn't make a lot of sense to do that. And with regard to the reentry amendment, I would hope that you'd also take that. It's the same type of thing. We're going to be doing it, if not, but I'd like to include it and have it. Once again, there's no cost to it because we're making sure that that there's no cost to it. And I just, it's something, in both these cases, they are very important to our fiscal future here because they affect how we handle these. We've got to start looking at the experiences, we can't go on with a 1900s system that's been modified maybe to 1950. We have to step into the 21st century and look at what actually works. And that's why these are really important, Mr. Chair. And they're going to be done one way or the other, and I'd prefer to have them done officially, have you included in the whole operation, and I just think that's the appropriate way to do this. They're big part of this, I think, will actually end up in making the public much more safe and actually making our state and local systems much more efficient and effective, which in the end run is something I hope we're all working for here, because we don't have a lot of dollars to spend extra, but we've got to protect public safety. And so I don't see how there's a downside to studying ways to make our system more effective to save the public and also at the same time save money. And so I just don't understand that. But once again, Mr. Chair, with regard to the A11 amendment, I support whatever Representative Morin wants to do on that. And so she would have to speak to your request with regard to that.
Okay. Well, why don't we, so it's your wish we bring up each amendment and vote on it then, knowing that...
If the chair is not
supporting your other two.
Well, Mr. Chair, we'll have to vote on it because I think it's important, and I want to know the people that don't support looking into the issues that are glaringly facing us with regard to public safety and ways that we can save money and be effective. So.
Okay. All right, why don't we start out with the A1 amendment, the acquisition, the easement. We've got Deputy Commissioner Christ here today somewhere. Why don't you just give us, Commissioner Christ, like a one-minute explanation of what this does.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is David Christ, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Corrections, and I can do it in a minute. There is a group of maintenance buildings about a quarter to half a mile away from the secure perimeter at the Faribault Prison that is connected to that facility by a road. There is a railroad that bisects that road. Prior to the DOC acquiring that property in the early 80s, there was overhead electrical service to that set of buildings, and there was gas, water, and sewer underneath the railroad to that building. About 4 years ago, we started having problems with the electrical service out there. The poles started to fall down, the lines started to sag. When storms would come through, the lines would touch one another, and that created a short circuit that would put out the power to the main facility. So we began the process of burying those lines, and then we found out that there's no documented evidence that there was ever a proper easement with the railroad for the water, gas, sewer, or electric. So at this point, we don't have electricity out to those buildings. Because we don't have electricity, we can't operate the gas furnaces out there, and without the gas furnaces, we can't have water service out there. So we are seeking authorization for the Department of Administration to negotiate an easement with the railroad so that we can restore those services.
Gotcha. Thank you, Deputy Commissioner. Any discussion on the amendment? I would offer the A1 amendment to House File 853. And discussion, if there is none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. The A2 amendment, is this yours, Representative Morantz?
It is.
What would you like to do? You have another amendment modifying this, and you heard me discuss it. Would you like to talk about it?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would I like to discuss my amendment or yours?
Would you like to offer your amendment? I don't support your amendment, but I do support part of it in that the language changed the way I've modified it. Have you looked at my amendment?
I have, and I would like to move my amendment.
Okay.
And explain why.
Okay, go ahead, ma'am.
Okay, so we have several deletions that I would like to offer. And I came in this morning, and I was debating back and forth about that I wanted to just really stay focused around the educational piece or just what is the requirement of the duties and responsibilities of the commissioner in the Department of Human Service. And I went back and forth, and I am at the place right now where I really believe that it's really important to move the amendment as is. And I do that because as I was walking into the state office building this morning in the Star Tribune, I saw the paper which says that our jobless gap here in the state of Minnesota is the worst in the nation between whites and blacks. And I'm like, wow, here we are in the 21st century, 2011, and we have this huge gap in opportunity for all people to be successful and thriving in our great state. And so because of that huge gap, I would like to go forward. And looking at page 6 and deleting lines 19 to 21, believing that the priority of the department is so much greater than just the enforcement measures, so I would like to delete that line. And looking at page 12 and deleting section 3, which is hugely around the educational component, I believe that is a huge piece that the Department of Human Services need to be a part of their mission. Looking at page 14 and deleting section 4, which is certificate of appliance, the hiring component of that is so crucial, even as we look at companies with less than 50 employees. I want to read something that I saw in the Star Tribune that talks about this huge gap that we have within the the job arena. And this is a statement by a person by the name of Benjamin Walker, who's 50 years old from Minneapolis. And he said that when he recently applied for a job at a muffler shop, the manager asked him, "How would you feel to be the only black working with a bunch of whites? Would it affect the quality of your work?" He insisted that it would not, but he still did not get the job. So in realizing that this is not just a silo instance, that this happens in great numbers, even in jobs where there are employees of less than 50, I think it's really a big part of what the Department of Human Rights need to do is they do their work to ensure that we are creating safe streets, because I believe opportunity and jobs create safer streets and communities. And looking at page 20 and deleting section 12, that's a repealer of human rights provided for the Human Rights Department to provide technical assistance to those who are out of compliance. Now, we have a compliance and a mandate for our companies to reach our hiring goals within communities of color. And I think if the Department of Human Rights is not there to help and support and guide companies to do what I believe they want to do, which is the right thing, to ensure that we're doing fair hiring, I believe that's that is definitely one of the jobs from the Department of Human Service. So in saying that, and speaking to community members and staff from the Department of Human Rights and other advocates, we believe that the Department of Human Rights can speak best at how they can service residents of the state of Minnesota. And we ask that, and I ask, and we ask that at the legislature, that we leave that responsibility for them to do that, knowing that they have a 65% reduction in revenue, that we believe, they believe, that they can best see how the human rights can best delegate the work that needs to be done to serve the residents. And I'm not sure if you, members here, if we know the impact or the effect that change in the work of the Department of Human Service can have on communities, families, mothers, fathers, and children who are all a part of community of color. So again, I ask members of this committee to allow the Department of Human Rights to delegate their work the way they best see is needed based on a 65% reduction coming from state funding. And I would like to request a roll call.
Roll call is being requested. It'll be taken when we get to the vote. Tom?
And I was also wondering if it would be, and it's talking to Commissioner Kevin Lindsay, if maybe if he can come down and just speak a minute or so on.
Sure, we can give him a minute. What did any of this amendment change any of the funding, the 65% cut?
No. I'm
so
that
I take it
the
DFL
funding.
Side agrees with us that the human rights should be cut 65%?
Absolutely not.
Why didn't you change it?
Absolutely not.
Why didn't you offer an amendment to change it then?
Well, offering an amendment to change the reduction would, in overnight time, we're just trying to find who should we cut and what that cut would look like for other entities that we are representing here in the state as funding. And
well, that's why I gave you 24 hours, so you could have found some place to cut, I would think. Somewhere, if you all thought it was so very important and critical to the mission, why did you agree with the cut?
Mr. Chair, may I be on record by saying I do not disagree with the cut. We do not. The work that they do and needs to be done in our state is critical to ensure that we have good representation, that we are allowing the rights of individuals to be fulfilled in a good follow-through manner. So the funding is a huge reduction in the services that they can provide. And so based on what we would like to see and what they would like to see to be that responsibility of the Department of Human Rights, I just believe and they believe, and just speaking to communities, members, and advocates of human rights, recognizing that discrimination is alive and well, that they can best do that work, and I think they can do it much better than we can do it in delegating how that can be best done. And so I decided to focus on that piece rather than the reduction of funds.
And I didn't ask that to antagonize anybody over there. I got a few of you upset, but it just seemed awful confusing amendment after you all have told us how critical the mission is and how we have to have them. Why you didn't go somewhere in the budget and change the formula in rather than just language. But
I think their mission is hugely important.
Okay.
As long as they're doing great work, good work that is really providing opportunities for everyone, I think that is the goal of the Department of Human Service, even if they have to go and do some fundraising and get other foundation money. You know, they would do what needs to be done, but the work within the Department of Human Service needs to really support what needs to be done around discrimination.
Okay. Is the gentleman here to testify? Yes, you have 1 minute if you'd like to use it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate having the opportunity to speak to the proposed amendment. First off, as it relates to the funding piece, obviously the governor had funded the agency at a certain level, and by submitting that budget, he made a statement as it relates to the importance of the work of the Department of Human Rights, and it is a critical one, and we do believe that it's an important one, given the issues which face Minnesota. The statistics cited by Representative Moran are accurate, and it has a significant impact on our state And going forward, if Minnesota is going to be a leader in the world, we need to address that inequity gap. As it relates to the second piece, and that is sort of what restraint do you put on the commissioner of the Department of Human Rights? We would suggest leave the tools in the toolbox. Allow us to best manage those tools and figure out what's the best way. Obviously, this is a new relationship. I've just started as a commissioner as March 2nd. But looking at all of the tools which are in the toolbox, I believe that would allow me and my staff the best opportunity to eradicate discrimination in the state of Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thanks, sir. And then could you state your name one more time for the...
Sure. It is Kevin Lindsay, Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Human Rights.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, mm-hmm. I would just like to again just state that, for the record, I do not support the cuts.
Okay. I think your amendment was the A2 amendment. Representative Moran moves the A2 amendment, which I don't support, and a roll call vote will be taken.
Cornish.
Nay.
Woodard.
No.
Mullery.
Aye.
Gauthier.
Aye.
Grunhagen.
No.
Hilty.
Aye.
Johnson. Kelly. Kiefer.
No.
Kreisel.
No.
Leidiger.
No.
Mariani.
Yes.
McDonald.
No.
Moran.
Yes.
Nornis.
No.
Slocum.
Aye.
Smith.
No.
Okay, the vote was 9 nays, 6 ayes, so the amendment fails. Yes, Mr.
Chair, just got a comment. A quick comment on the vote, or some of the issues prior to the vote. You know, one of the reasons I voted, I do support the reduction in human rights, and one of the reasons I voted the way I did is because I believe the disparity in hiring can best be addressed, or needs to be addressed, through our educational program. I think the primary reason we're seeing that disparity between whites and minorities or blacks or whatever you want to say is because we have a public educational system that is failing our children in the inner city. It borders on a criminal behavior, and that's where we need to concentrate our scarce resources. And one of the things I would just say is it's the academic techniques that are being used in those public schools. And I'll give you one example, and that's whole language or basal literature.
Short example, Representative.
Yeah, sure, I know. I got to keep it at 1 minute, right? You know, you teach whole language or basal literature, it causes reading problems. I spent 13 years in jail ministry, unpaid, by the way, and most of those people cannot read very well. So it's a contributing factor. So if you want to eliminate that discrimination, that hiring gap, we need to concentrate on educational reform. So I hope those of you who are concerned about it will support our omnibus education budget, which includes needed reforms, especially in our inner city, to allow our children there an option outside the public educational system, which in many cases is failing them, and they're trapped in it. That's I can keep going, but
Mr.
that's fine.
Chair?
Mr. Chair,
are we going to debate after votes or before votes?
That's a very good question. Hopefully, we'll move along. All right, let's jump up to, as long as we're on this subject, and take care of the A11 amendment if you want to sort through it. And that is the counteroffer to that amendment we did. And the chair would move the A11 amendment to House File 853. Basically, this, and we've advised Mr. Lindsay of this too, it's a commissioner may use non-state funds to develop and conduct programs of formal and informal education designed to eliminate discrimination, further compliance with this chapter. What we did here is we wanted to make clear that Mr. Lindsay would still have the ability to meet the criteria for federal grants, or hopefully move in that direction with this amendment, because he said yesterday the way the language was, that he might not qualify, so we're trying to take care of that, and then to narrow the state funds to enforcement and the Fed funds to education and outreach. Any discussion on the amendment? Representative Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for the attempt, but it's really an empty amendment because we've just stripped all the tools out of the toolbox to do the job. And we've narrowed the responsibility of the Department of Human Rights to mere enforcement of complaints. So I don't see how this gets us anywhere in defending human rights in the state of Minnesota.
Okay, any other comments, questions? Chair moves the A11 amendment.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
I know that it's... Could I just speak 30 seconds?
No. We're going to move on. The chair moves the A11 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Okay, motion carries. Yeah. Yeah, go ahead, Mr.
Chair. I would be remiss if I didn't, and I'll be very brief, but I have to say that when the legislature refuses to hear from a commissioner on an issue that we're about to vote before us, that's sort of unprecedented. And I don't think it's, I think it's beneath us as a legislature to conduct ourselves that way.
Thank you for your input, but I think we've had him up here how many times now, commissioners? Three? In front of us, so I think we've given. So anyway, I think we had ample opportunity to give the commissioner in every respect that he deserves. He's doing a good job as far as we can tell, and that's why we gave him three times to talk. Okay, next amendment. This is... okay, the Representative Mueller, is this your amendment, the A3? Do you want to speak to it?
Mr. Chairman, my understanding is that you want to amend lines 219, 220, and 223 to be one?
Is yes.
Correct?
A3-2? Representative Mueller, remind us the A3-2 that would amend yours. Is it okay with the GFL members if we run a few minutes over? Okay. Rather than come back tonight. Representative Mueller, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. What did you want to change on this amendment?
My A3-2 amendment would be the juvenile justice reform. It's basically yours amended to my thoughts. Or on the it reduces the attendance, I think, to the ones instead of two of each, and just changes where you put amending. I didn't prefer that language because it looked like it was a foregone conclusion that we were going to amend, and so this one just uses language to study that to see if we are going to amend.
So, Mr. Chairman,
but everything is there.
I would be scared to adopt your thinking, but I think in this case I don't have a problem with the changes as they've been explained to me by Ms. Perius, so I'll either amend my amendment or author or whatever, do A3-2 or do however you want to handle that.
Yeah, Representative Mueller, do you wish to move my amendment?
That's fine, Mr. Chair.
Okay, sounds good. Representative Mueller, you've moved the A3-2 amendment to House File 853. Any comments or questions? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. So then we get down to A5 amendment. Who is the author of this?
Mr. Chairman, I am. Why don't we do the A-10 and the A-8 first?
A-10 first? Sure. Okay, Representative Munnery, go ahead.
The A-10, Mr. Chairman, this just, what it does is specifically it lists certain issues that really have to be dealt with. They're out there, and there's no question from both agencies and community that people in those and in probation think that we need to start looking at this and adopting a way to see how we can really be effective. We've got to move into looking at data on what is effective and not, rather than going down to the corner bar and asking them what they think should be done. And I expect that not only will we greatly increase public safety if we answer these questions and start moving in the right direction, but on top of that, I think that there'll be an overall savings of money, and so we'll be both more effective and efficient. And so basically that's why I want this these issues studied. We're going to somehow do it anyhow, and it really would be good to be part of the task force.
Okay, Representative Mulder, rather you did it the other how and gave us your report on that in due time, but the reason that I didn't prefer your amendment is because we've already got a long list to go through, and my experience with the task force is that even in the limited number of subjects, it gets wound up, and that was the other reason that I reduced your two attendance to one, because you get so many people talking and so many people with inputs. The CRIMNET board that I was on was twice as big as our committee, and it went on and on and on. And so if we add too many tasks, I'm just afraid that it'll take away from the effectiveness of the task force that I wanted to create.
Well, Mr. Chair, if we don't deal with these, then it's an ineffective task force. So these are issues that have to be dealt with. So if they're not dealt with, why are we even doing the task force? Because we have to do that. With regard to CRIMNET, as I explained to you last night, I've been on that, and the reason I had put two on the other, people from, was one to represent Metro and one to represent rural, because, or greater Minnesota, because there are differences, and I think it's good to have that, but I wasn't going to fight over that, whether it's one or two from, for instance, probation or from police or whatever. I do think that there's no question that we have to answer these, or we're in an effective task force. So I don't see any point in doing a task force that's not going to deal with the issues out there that are facing us.
Okay, Representative Munnery, if...
And I'd ask for a roll call, Mr. Chair.
Okay, a roll call will be taken on the A-10 amendment when we get to it. The... you are listed as a minority, a ranking minority member, and you will be able to bring these issues up when it comes to this. And I just don't want them on the task force list, because it's just going to inundate us in subjects, and we're going to end up be like the 27-25 work group for forfeiture that spent a year looking at something, never came up with any results. And it was like one of the members said, because a root canal sitting in that thing. So,
Mr. Chair, I agree totally with yours, and I think that was Mr. Flaherty. I'm not sure, but I totally, from the beginning, I saw that was set up as basically creating conflict in intractable positions from the first, and I called that the most dysfunctional task force I had seen, and I was correct. But this one, I think, has issues where, and people on it that will come together to try and work out proper solutions. So I don't think we should ever even look at task forces as being something that was set up the way that one was, and using that as an example, because we have a lot of huge number of very effective task forces.
Okay, Representative Mulder has moved the A-10 amendment and asked for a roll call. Go ahead.
Cornish.
Nay.
Woodard.
No.
Mullery.
Aye.
Gauthier.
Aye.
Grunhagen.
No.
Hilty.
Aye.
Johnson. Kelly.
No.
Kiefer.
No.
Kreisel.
No.
Leidiger.
No.
Mariani.
Aye.
McDonald.
No.
Moran.
Aye.
Nornis.
No.
Slocum.
Aye.
Smith.
No.
Okay, 10 nays and 6 ayes. Amendment fails. The Representative Mueller, I don't really, I'm not fussy how the remaining amendments are
Mr.
taken.
Mr. Chair,
in order.
I think we should probably do the A8.
A8?
And I'm not going to do the A7.
Okay. Representative Mueller, to the A8 amendment.
Mr. Chair, in talking to law enforcement, the biggest issue probably facing them is recidivism. And that's largely a failure of our reentry system. And so this is a task force that will, and again, I don't care if you wanted to change the 2-to-1 representative of certain things, but we absolutely have to, again, step into at least the 20th century and hopefully into the 21st century on how we deal with ex-felons and getting them back into the system. As we heard earlier, there's, I think it was 64% have mental illness, 72% of those chemical dependency on top of that, plus more. We have to figure out how we get them back into the system, get them trained into jobs and back with good probation that has the time and effective tools to keep them out of committing more crime. And Mr. Chair, the system we got now where there's a lot of recidivism just makes no sense. The cost to society itself is huge and often ineffective, and so we have to start looking at ways where we both help the offender back and becoming a good member of society and help society and protect society from more crime, and also do it in a very effective, cost-efficient way. So that's why I asked for this task force.
Okay, Representative Mueller, as we discussed last night, I wasn't in favor of this task force and just didn't want to load up the omnibus bill with too many task force and could consider taking this as a policy task force later. And I would really like to look at how many studies are already done on the internet and books and how many things we've asked the corrections to do about this before in current programs before I assigned yet another task force to look at the reentry. And so I just wasn't in favor of putting this on my omnibus bill.
Mr. Chairman, as you expressed to me, you wanted to have the sexual offender task force in here also so it didn't have to go through all kinds of other committees. I think this committee is the one that should be determining this. It has a huge effect on our future budgets. Because if we can start doing this right, we'll be affecting the money that the state has to pay for these programs. And I still want to pursue and offer it as an amendment because I think it's important to this committee to get it in and working. It may even affect our budget for next year for the committee.
Representative Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to support the amendment, but I do want to note, and one of the shortcomings I see with these task force is that we list a lot of state employees or members of the legislature or other organizations in law enforcement, but we never talk about Joe Citizen being a member of these things, and I just want that duly noted.
Okay. Questions, comments? On the Representative Mullery's A8 amendment, comments and questions, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Opposed?
Roll?
No.
Well, that was a weak response. It fails anyway. Nobody had their coffee, obviously. The A5 amendment is our last amendment, and this amendment belongs to...
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, what did you say?
Oh, the A5 amendment?
Oh, Mr. Chairman, that's mine.
Okay, Representative Muller, through the A5 amendment.
Mr. Chairman, basically what this is deleting your Article 3, which I believe, and it's with that it's clearly unconstitutional, and the people I've talked to think so also. You can't take away the rights of public employees. There are, as was expressed by the Pension Commission director, Minnesota is a reliance state, and when you're working and all the time you're under a particular pension system with certain rights in that pension system, you can't take it away. You've relied on it, and courts, most of the courts around the country, I also saw a digest a few years ago of all of the cases on these issues around the country. There's, I forget, something like 85 cases, and well over 90% of the courts around the country upheld this type of system. So I think that's clearly unconstitutional. I believe what you're also doing in that, it seems to be, is affecting a collectively bargained contract, which we also can't just go overriding. There's constitutionality based on contracts. And so while I don't believe we should do it, we can change PELRA in the future that doesn't regard any present contracts or automatic extensions of those. We can't affect present contracts. So, first of all, it's clearly, I believe, unconstitutional, Article 3, and it's also just a plain unfair system. When I'm talking to not just people in the Department of Corrections, but law enforcement, they think this is the wrong thing to do. They think it's unfair to be, they consider themselves, many police consider this whole system to be part of the anti-crime effort, and they understand that these people are important to that and that they're right in the system. They're going through the same types of dangers day by day as the line officers often. We've heard testimony from the representatives of both employment and workers in the system, and many of these people are in danger daily and in fact are trained that they have to come and actually get into even physical interactions or abuse at times. So from both the unconstitutionality and from the fact that it's just the way we should be treating our really good state employees, that's the basis of this amendment, why we need to do it.
Representative Mullery, would you mind listing for me the names of the law enforcement groups that have talked to you about this insurance or this retirement bill?
Mr. Chair, I haven't gone to any of the law enforcement groups. I've just talked to various cops at different times.
How many, you think?
Oh, I don't know, half dozen or something.
The state troopers, conservation officers, gambling enforcement agents, fugitive apprehension task force. There was five unions, one law enforcement that switched our retirement plan from a 3-year to a 10-year. When I was on the committee, we switched that years ago to take care of a problem like this. Where are we at? Representative Hilty, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I won't belabor this. this is simply the wrong thing to do, to leave this provision in the bill. And, Mr. Chair, I would ask for a roll call.
Okay. Roll call has been requested and will be taken. Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, I don't want to engage in a debate with Representative Mulry, but the word constitutionality and unconstitutional has been used in the Judiciary Policy and Finance Committee in challenging that particular chairman's presentation of the bill. And I stayed up late last night. I'll provide it to you tomorrow, but I found the Minnesota Supreme Court precedent on this, and the bills that we pass are presumed to be constitutional, and only in compelling and extreme cases will they be held unconstitutional. So we do have the presumption of constitutionality of everything that we pass.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, I'm very well aware of that, but I'm also looking at the Christensen case in the 1993 Minneapolis teachers case in the appellate court.
Okay. All right, A5 amendment has been offered. The roll call has been requested. There's no more questions. The roll call will be taken.
Cornish.
Nay.
Woodard.
No.
Mullery.
Aye.
Gauthier.
Aye.
Grunhagen.
No.
Hilty.
Aye.
Kelly.
No.
Kiefer.
No.
Kreisel.
No.
Leidiger.
No.
Mariani.
Yes.
McDonald.
No.
Moran.
Yes.
Nornes.
No.
Slocum.
Aye.
Smith.
No.
Okay, the vote was 10 nay and 6 a, so the amendment fails. Now, I think we've completed our work on House File 853 as amended.
Mr. Chair, we'll.
Yes.
We'd like a roll call on that.
Right.
When we get to it.
Okay. House File 853, it's going to be a roll call vote taken. I'd like to thank the DFL members for their participation in the offering of the amendments in good faith, and thank you very much to the staff who has worked so hard. And so I don't miss anybody, I'll just say everybody on the staff. I want to start naming names here. Because every time I do that, I'll miss one name, and then somebody will remind me later, and I'll feel terrible. So thank you to my GOP members. And we did the best that we could do with what we had to work with, and it'll be argued from here to the Ways and Means, to the floor, to the conference committee, to the governor. And I have no doubt that these numbers and language will change this way, that way, and every way. The target will probably change. Who knows which direction, but it's been good working with you. No hard feelings, even though I didn't take some of your amendments. And Representative Mullery, as the ranking member, do you have any comments on the close of the bill?
Mr. Chair, I would like to comment on the bill. And Mr. Chair, I realize that you got a target that may not be what you wanted, but we have to make a statement that we don't want cutting public safety. And I think all of us feel that public safety is probably the number one thing that government has to do for the people of the state. So this is an extremely important issue to properly fund public safety. And Mr. Chair, I know I don't doubt at all that you want to be tough on crime, just as I want to be tough on crime. And but there are the right ways or most effective ways to do it, and then there's other ineffective ways, and we have to learn from experience. And I do want to thank you. You already expressed the fact that you put in some of the things that Representative Johnson and I made as suggestions, and we want to thank you for, because we believe that that's going to make it both more effective and more efficient. But the plain fact is, I think we'll probably all be voting against this because it does cut public safety. And there's just a lot of problems, even though you may have tried to do what you feel is best for public safety. Probation is receiving cuts. That's going to affect all of the communities that we are in, all over the state. There's the unfunded local mandate that's in there. We're taking away, probably illegally, almost certainly illegally, the funding from the emergency responders. There's really drastic cuts to a human rights department. I believe it's roughly two-thirds, and that protects all Minnesotans. It's if we're the one being discriminated against, and it's not just, you never know who it's going to be, because it affects race, ethnic, religion. Age is a very common one now, and looking around the room, there's some of us, and not just me, Mr. Chair, but I can see another person who's probably could be faced with that at some place. It's really important also, it's going to be really hard to enforce the department's responsibilities. When you cut them two-thirds, how can they do it when they're not even able right now to enforce compliance with our state laws on contracting? And it's really important that we do this. There's no question there was discrimination in the past in this state, and we need to follow the laws that we have. And most businesses in this state are really good and want these laws enforced. They comply, and they're very upset when those laws aren't enforced. I happen to be working with a lot of contractors on different issues, and by and large, they really believe in these, that we need to bring in people of all races and ethnic groups. And so we're looking at that. We're taking away, now that my amendment was defeated, I believe we're taking unconstitutionally away the rights that they've earned for public employees. We've cut money for advocates, for instance, for raped women or battered women. It's difficult to face, can be very intimidating, the court system and other things that they have to face at that time. And we're cutting that. We're turning down studies, which doesn't make any sense to me at all, Mr. Chair, why we're not studying how we can move into the future, follow what other states are doing that's effective on being actually saving public safety and at the same time cutting costs, which we're going to have to do in the future. So I think just briefly that's why at least I have to vote against this. We just have to try to protect public safety, and that's my view. But and Mr. Chair, as I said, and you said that you understand where we're coming from, and I understand that you're also concerned about public safety. Just that's our position.
Thank you, Arthur Mullery. Representative Slocum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I, with all due respect, Mr. Chair, I won't be voting for this bill either. I find it wrong on many levels. This bill raids accounts and funds that are dedicated to other purposes. That's wrong. This bill undercuts collective bargaining rights for people in the correctional retirement plan. That's wrong. This bill eliminates appropriate funding for proven programs for victims of violence in our state. That's wrong. The bill diminishes the Civil Rights Department, its ability to educate the public and employers in particular, and given the Star Tribune article this morning, that's wrong. My Republican colleagues, you know, I respect you, we have differences of opinion, but you would rather roll out this bill that causes statewide hurt rather than ask 5% of Minnesotans to pay their fair share in taxes. That's wrong.
And you folks all night long couldn't come up with any money for the Human Rights Department. Representative Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the people of this community all share a passion for public safety, and I don't question that. Our party did, through the governor, present a budget. So to accuse us of not coming up with money, that's not true. It was proposed by the governor. We support the governor. My disappointment comes in a couple of areas. I think some of the things in the bill are tolerable, but there's just some things that are just wrong with it. To sit and accept testimony from the Acting Commissioner of Human Rights saying we're at a tipping point of being effective, of dealing with discrimination, and then to gut the department by 65% clearly sends a signal to people in Minnesota that human rights and discrimination cases aren't important to the state. And I think that's wrong. I think we put in generic language trying to correct things when we've heard the commissioner say, if the state doesn't ante up, we're not going to get any other funds. So that's wrong. So we can't even educate people about discrimination. To let companies off the hook and say, well, it's all right. Because I know as a city councilor, there are many times contracts got held up because they didn't meet the criteria of the state human rights. And that's wrong. To take armor funds and shift them when we've been told we're risking federal funds because of that is wrong. And to go with a collective bargaining agreement that was done in good faith. Now, we can talk about changing the pension, and I'm okay with talking about changes, but the process is wrong. We need to engage our employees. Every day they put themselves on the line for the people of Minnesota to keep us safe, and then we simply arbitrarily negate their pension plan that was negotiated in good faith. That is wrong. This is a bad bill. I know it's going to pass out of committee today. I know that we will argue it on the floor, and I hope to God the governor vetoes it, and then we can get down to seriously negotiating what's right for Minnesota and public safety.
Representative Gauthier, why didn't you move that amendment? You were going to take money from the BCA and give it to corrections. Why didn't you give it to the Human Rights Department if it was so important to everybody and we're exclaiming how important human rights is at a tipping point, but yet you wouldn't give them any more money?
Chairman Cornish, mm-hmm. We clearly support the governor's position, and we intend to vote on that basis.
But the governor isn't here today. It's your job to look out for the Human Rights Department, and you obviously thought corrections was more important. Representative Woodward.
Thank you, Chair, and I'll be very brief, but I appreciate this bill. I think it is a good bill. I know it's got some things in it that people don't like, and I understand that. And I also understand the Star Tribune article that Representative Moran has presented to us as a case for why human rights are in trouble here in Minnesota. I would argue that there's a better way to do it than through the Department of Human Rights. I mean, we obviously spend a lot of money through the Department of Human Rights right now, and we're in this position. So I think this is a very judicious way of approaching this particular issue. And we have protected a lot of areas within the public safety budget. And I do think this is a good bill. I'd like to thank you for helping us get to this point, Chairman Cornish. And I'd like to thank the members of this committee, too, who have helped us put this together. So thank you.
Okay, thank you, Representative Woodard. Representative Kelly?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the position you're in. I recall just 2 years ago sitting on this same committee with Chair Paymar at that time and having these similar discussions, and Representative Guthrie, you're exactly right. We're all passionate about public safety. And I remember being in the minority and accepting the fact that we're in a tough position, but we all have to make choices. I think we just have a different opinion of what the general public has told us. I believe they've told us that, you know, we're going through tough times and we've had to live within our means we always have to live within our means and our family budgets. And we're asking the state to do the same. The new forecast gave us an 8% increase in revenue. I believe we're doing what we can with what we have. And no one around this table appreciates having to make the decisions we have as we've listened to all the testimony. But I do appreciate the work that we've done, the conversations that we've had, and appreciate this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, no other comments. The Chair will close with a talk to the crowd here. The OJP cuts have come in a number of other times, not so severe as this, but we're in a worse situation with the budget than we ever have been. And another thing is that you've heard emotional testimony and stories about people dying and getting sick. In almost every committee, excuse me, in the legislature, you're going to hear this. The problems we face is they say if we don't fix the highways, people are going to die. If we don't give the kids in school enough money, people are going to get sick. They're going to end up in prison. If we don't fund health care, people are in every situation, every committee. The threat is to the legislature that people are going to die or get sick, it seems like. So we realize how important these decisions are, and we don't take it lightly. But you can imagine the pressure under when everybody gives us the same report on the drastic effects we're going to have from health care to education to transportation to public safety. So in many ways, this committee is not different than any other. We make these same type decisions. If there was some other way we could go, we probably would, but we were forced into this situation. I don't blame anybody here, and as much as kibitzing you here back and forth, I actually like these people across the table, and they're friends of mine.
We like you too.
I consider them friends. But we just disagree philosophically in a number of issues, and that is very apparent here. But I thank them for their work and helping us out, and thank you for your testimony. And Commissioner Lindsay, I hope you don't think that I was rude today. I think you're a good man doing a good job, and we just can't afford to fund you like you would like to be. So thank you very much, and now we will move, without any further ado, House File 853 as amended, recommended to pass, and re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee, and with the authority to the staff to make the necessary corrections in the spreadsheet. And a roll call vote. All right.
Cornish.
Aye.
Woodard.
Yes.
Mullery.
Nay.
Gauthier.
Nay.
Grunhagen.
Yes.
Hilty.
No.
Johnson. Kelly.
Yes.
Kiefer.
Yes.
Kreisel.
Yes.
Leidiger.
Yes.
Mariani.
No.
McDonald.
Yes.
Moran.
No.
Nornis.
Yes.
Slocum.
No.
Smith.
Yes.
Okay, with a vote of 10 ayes and 6 nays, House File 853 as amended is passed. Thank you very much. And if there's any other announcements, so we're meeting adjourned.
Well, I argue that.